ladies and gentlemen, to Science Faction, the only show where a scientist, a comedian, and a comedian scientist come together to discuss science comedically.
Hello, and welcome to Science Faction 169. Science Faction, the contest is still ongoing.
You wouldn't know it looking at our Twitter feed this week,
though. That's true. We didn't get enough tweets this week.
Anybody who was going to vote has voted already. I think that's the lesson.
If you guys remember, we, of course, are having a contest to see which topic we should cover in our intro section at the beginning of every episode. We started with the periodic table of the elements, 1 through 118. We moved on to the logical fallacies, and now we need a new science topic to cover. We have one more week for you to tweet your suggestions at Faction Science to us. What should we cover every single week at our introduction?
What's on the list so far?
My favorite one is the geological eras. I think starting, you know, at the very beginning, 4.5 billion years ago and going all the way to now, that would be very useful. It's a common thing in science.
Anti-science congressman.
That would be great. I'm in favor of that.
Discoveries in certain areas, states, or cities within the United States and the discoverers that found them.
Euphemisms for dong.
No, stop suggesting that one every time.
Oh, it almost stuck
female
in there.
Female scientists.
We actually did that for a while. We did do female scientists for a while.
And then I came on and
Then we're like, you've ruined it for everybody anyway. No one's going to buy this.
This clears the requirement the court had upon us, so we're fine.
Speaking of somebody who's fine, I, of course, am your host, comedian archaeologist Robert Timothy. With me, as always, is my comedian, Mr. Damien Mercado. Damien, how are you doing this afternoon?
Doing great. I'm eagerly awaiting the Twitter feed. I'm like one of the operators at a telethon. Please, I need your suggestions. One suggestion of euphemism for dong makes it legitimate and up for vote.
Nothing you do is ever legitimate. And of course, our scientist for the evening, Dr. Ava. Dr. Ava, how are you?
I'm good. I'm mentally already almost in Germany. So this is...
I thought you were always mentally in Germany.
No.
Well, then you have to explain the high-stepping.
I'll be in Germany over the summer, so I will be sorely missed.
You will absolutely be missed. Yeah. You were missed as you were gone these past few weeks. You will be missed again when you were in Germany.
We have a globe-trotting scientist on this show. I mean, we have a lot of scientists on this show, but only one.
I can't send you postcards from around the world during this summer.
If you could send me dick pics from the men of various nations of wherever you'd go, just for my catalog.
No problem.
First of all, he's already suggesting euphemisms for dong. I don't need him Instagramming it, so let's just keep that between us.
Oh, and any euphemisms you pick up, local colloquialisms for dong in Germany, let's...
I actually have a friend, an Italian friend, and we figured out the other day that Italian is the only language that we know of where you can say that something is a vagina means that something's really cool.
Oh, so, like, damn, that's pussy.
Yeah, exactly.
All right.
Yeah, so you can say che figa.
But you know what? We do
and
that.
It means this is great.
We do that with boobs. We can say that's tits. And that means that's great.
Are you serious?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. This show is tits.
Just because you don't see it in an academic paper doesn't mean that there isn't the tits.
You would be surprised what my undergraduates are teaching me, but they haven't taught me that one. They taught me lit last week.
Okay.
What's so funny?
You say that like somebody's mom. All right.
I guess that's because I'm somebody's mom.
And if you want to get lit, come on out to the Madhouse Comedy Club where we tape this podcast. And when you're not doing that, go ahead and check out our website at www.thesciencefaction.com for all the articles we cover here, as well as some we didn't get to. But for now, let's move right on to science articles.
From molecules to particles, this is Science Articles.
Can you say woke for me, Dr. Ava? like in a sentence, like, my son's friends are woke.
I don't think four-year-olds are described that way.
My son's friends are woke.
Nailed it.
There we go.
That was everything I needed.
All right, guys. Article number one. Did we just lose 80% of the universe? A very, very interesting...
Wait, what? There was another crash?
Yes, and it destroyed 80% of the universe.
Thought like this was Lord Xenu again.
So very, very interesting topic. You've seen it hit all the headlines on major news sources as well as science news sources. The idea from a recent paper that dark energy may in fact not exist.
Wait, but we all know who Donald Trump is.
He's got that dark energy.
You're saying the emperor is in charge now, so it's all around us. It's no longer constrained to just 80% of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
This will take away Voldemort's power. So if you guys don't know, let's go over kind of the concept of the universe physicists currently have that include dark energy. So we have basically the matter, all the things that we normally see, ordinary matter, suns, stars, planets, moons, asteroid belts, all of that make up normal matter. And we think that's a very small percentage of the universe, something like
5%. So it doesn't actually matter.
Right, it doesn't. Matter doesn't matter. It's only about 5% of the known universe. But what we started finding out after a while was that that could not account for all the gravity we see in the world. And so starting around the 60s, we started coming up with this idea of dark matter, which is matter we can't actually see. We know it's there because we can see its gravitational effects, but we don't know what it is. We can see its effects, so we call it dark matter. Then, in about the 1990s, what we started noticing is that the universe was accelerating away from each other. Now, we can see this from things like Doppler shifts, the shift to red. When something is moving away from you, the light that's coming towards you shifts across the spectrum to a red shift. And so
have sunsets ruined for me forever now.
So we knew that the universe was expanding, and we have known that for a little bit. But in the 90s, what we started realizing is it wasn't just expanding, but this expansion was accelerating. That doesn't make sense in a common physics model.
I'm picturing a scientist in the physics lab working this out and, you know, eureka, and then you pan out and you see he has a kid in play haircut, you know, wearing LA Light shoes, watching in living color in the
background.
That's
exactly how science was done in the 90s. You're correct. What we found was it's accelerating more and more. That doesn't work with the standard Big Bang model. What should happen is either the universe continues to accelerate at the constant rate, or more likely, because of the gravity inside, it accelerates more slowly and more slowly until it eventually stops and then comes back into a crunch. That is not what we saw. We saw a continued acceleration.
Well, maybe there's another universe like out there that drags it.
That's pulling
itself.
It, but it would have to be universes from all angles pulling mm-hmm. it at all points.
I like what Dr. Ava's saying. A good point, Dr. Ava.
This is how flat earth theories get started. But no, so what we thought was, oh my God, what is this thing? What could possibly account for continued acceleration in this manner? And the only thing was this theoretical concept called dark energy, which is basically accounts for a gigantic percentage of the universe, what we think would be about 80%. And it would be a force that's constantly pushing the universe to continue to accelerate at a faster and faster pace. Now, I want to distinguish this from dark matter. Dark matter is something we see the direct effects of. We know it's there. We know there's something there. We just can't see it. We don't know what it is. It could be black holes. It could be a lot of things, but we know that it's there because we see the gravity. It can be measured. Dark energy is a theoretical construct. It is one way to explain a phenomenon that we see going on, and we have no idea what it would be. We have no concept of what this energy could be. We don't know where it exists. All we are doing is giving a name to an unknown agent that we think is causing this universe expansion. So that's kind of where we settle.
Kind of like the Russians.
It's exactly like the Russians in the U.S. election.
Why call it dark energy, though?
Energy is the idea that it is some kind of energy that's causing work or causing the expansion of the universe. Dark meaning we don't know what it is. So that is the current physics model. What this new paper suggests is maybe there's no such thing as dark energy. What they did is they started doing some more complex mathematical constructs, and what they discovered was maybe if we account for different distributions of matter and dark matter throughout the universe in certain ways, what appears to us to be an accelerated expansion might not actually be an overall accelerated expansion. It's a local accelerated expansion, meaning what we're observing looks like a continuing expanding universe that's expanding at a faster and faster rate. What's actually happening is it's expanding at a faster and faster rate in certain localities and then slower in other localities, and the overall net expansion is zero or maybe even negative, so therefore you don't need dark energy to account for it. And what they're saying is we now have more advanced mathematical and computer models, and these models show that maybe the expansion of the universe does not need dark energy. That's an amazing thing, because if this turns out to be true, it's going to overturn the last 20 to 30 years of physics. It's also going to be a holy grail for researchers, for cosmologists, for astrophysicists. I'm sure Seb will love it.
If he acknowledges it.
Yeah, if he even acknowledges that it exists. Now, one thing we should keep in mind, this is one paper, a single paper. So this is not, oh, we've completely overturned physics already. This is a tantalizing clue, a hint at what might be. What we're going to need to see is follow-up papers from other cosmologists, other astrophysicists, looking at this and saying, yeah, they're right, actually. When we do the mathematical calculations, it looks like we are just seeing local continued acceleration, expanding acceleration, whereas globally over the entire universe, it is a zero or a negative acceleration overall, or at least a slowing down of acceleration. That would be very interesting. We will need to see that come out. unlike other things that would overturn major parts of physics, this is actually kind of exciting because this is a part of physics that could be overturned relatively easily. If we were somebody to say, hey, there's no black holes, you'd have to explain all the observations that we have of things like black holes. Now, you can't see a black hole directly, but you can see a black hole sucking in stars. We have the gravitational waves of two black holes colliding.
Damien, don't even make that joke.
Yeah, I already see it in his mind.
No, I'm actually thinking of a much more clean joke that actually insults science way more than this.
But to overturn dark energy, really, a good mathematical model is all you need, because right now, the only thing that supports dark energy is itself a mathematical model. So while this is only one paper, and while we need to look at this skeptically, this is kind of exciting because it really does have the possibility of overturning what is considered kind of set science at this point.
If this turns out to be true, that if 80% of the known universe is now gone, does that mean it's much more feasible for us to get to Mars? Does that mean the trip to Mars is 80% shorter?
This has nothing to do with that.
I don't understand.
Clearly. So when you do think about this, think about the two things that we always talk about in science. One is extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So one paper is not necessarily going to do that. But contrast that with something called Hitchens razor, which is basically that claims made without evidence can be denied or disregarded without evidence. And while dark energy doesn't have no evidence for it, there's far less than there would be for basically any other physical phenomenon. So this is something we might see literally in the next few years completely change on the physics landscape. Astrophysics as we know it, physics in general, could be completely wiped into a different direction with this discovery if it turns out that it's supported by more and more additional research.
I would be there opening night to see Hitchens razor. God is dead. Mother Teresa's a bitch.
Yeah, he did do both of those things, but now he is also passed on, so I guess it equals out.
You know, maybe he should be challenged. You know, Christopher Hitchens, he might be on the docket. He wasn't a scientist, technically, but he was a science enthusiast.
That's true. You know what? It would be interesting to talk to Hitchens.
You know what? Thank you for reminding me that Hitchens is dead, and that I should probably not try to do his voice now, actually, because it'd be insulting for him
that
I did an impression of him when he was eventually summoned at a later future date.
That would be insulting, just like you insult every scientist you pretend to channel.
And I could do it. Dead on fucking Hitchens, which is unfortunate.
Very, very interesting stuff. Can't wait to see the follow-up publications on this. This really will be one of those things that could change around science in a huge way in the next few years. Can't wait for that. Let's move right on to article number two. Article number two, the celiac virus.
Are you talking about the gluten-free everything on everything like that virus in society?
So before we get into this, we should talk about the difference between actual gluten insensitivity and imagined gluten insensitivity, which makes up about 90% of gluten insensitivity is the imagined kind.
Yeah, my shampoo bottle says gluten-free on it because
you're
idiots.
Imitating me.
Because they're fucking idiots in this country. And I say that as a fucking idiot.
Indeed, most of the people who claim to have gluten insensitivity are either lying or completely psychosomatic, because it is not nearly as common as people think it is. While gluten can be hard to digest, strong levels gluten insensitivity, the kind that some people claim to have, is fairly rare, the type that we see accompany celiac disease. And by the way, I have a friend who has celiacs, and it's actually very annoying to them.
It's really bad.
Because what happens to them is it used to be, you know, she grew up her entire life with celiacs, as many people do, and it used to be that she would go to a store and it would say gluten-free for celiacs or something like that. And she could trust that because she had to, because she can die if she has too much gluten. But now she goes there, and because it's become such a fad and becomes like a sticker like that's meaningless almost. It's like when people put organic on food, it becomes a point where she has to question it, read the ingredients, read the label, and make sure it actually doesn't have gluten in it.
So wait, you're saying my shampoo might actually have gluten in it?
That's right. No wonder your hair is so wavy.
Wait, was it? So I don't understand. There are some things in this country that I don't understand, even after having lived here for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
There is a Consumer Protection Agency,
right?
That should actually watch out that labels match what they're supposed to match.
Right.
So you're telling me that gluten-free and organic and all these things don't have a clear definition anymore?
Well, organic literally is just a sham. I mean, the actual definition of organic is carbon-based. So just start with that.
Yeah,
people who have created this
apart from that.
Right.
But so in the EU, there are like pretty strict guidelines about what you can label organic or not.
Right,
and obviously it's a range, and you can never exclude like foreign Poland and all that stuff.
Actually, you can't exclude Poland. It's called Brexit, and they did it.
I know.
Well, let me just put it this way. We won't go too much into organic, but the definition of organic is completely subjective. So what they say is you have to use these type of fertilizers that we claim are organic. Mm-hmm. There is literally no difference between them and the non-organic fertilizers. It's just that the people who make the quote-unquote organic fertilizers were the ones who wrote the laws. And so it is a completely subjective, nonsensical definition. And there's a lot of reasons why it is, but it's essentially meaningless. And that's what they're turning the gluten-free into. Now, if you're at a store and you buy something that says gluten-free, you're probably okay if it's in official packaging and labeling. But what a lot of people are doing is buying stuff from farmers markets. And the term gluten-free has become a buzzword in the same way organic is a buzzword.
I think if the farmers markets are a problem, then we don't have a big problem.
You don't know hipsters. But real gluten insensitivity is a problem. And there is a range from people with complete celiacs to people who just get an upset stomach or something. But so much of it is psychosomatic. And one of the things my friend brings up all the time, and she goes, because people will say it around her, oh, I'm also gluten insensitive. And she goes, oh, interesting. Where do you get your medication from? And they're like, I just take regular medication. And she goes, okay, so you're lying. Because pills are almost solid gluten. That's the filler and the binder they use for almost all medications. She has to get special order medications that don't have gluten binders in it. Otherwise, she can go into shock if she takes a regular pill. So if you're a regular person, if you're somebody who claims to have gluten insensitivity and you're taking just regular off-the-shelf pills, you probably don't.
You have a gluten-free pill. It tastes terrible. It crumbles in your mouth. You're like, oh, come on, where's the savory flavor that comes with my Advil?
But there is an issue with celiac disease. Celiac disease itself is actually showing a rise and uptick, meaning that there is something that we should be aware of.
If people are stupid enough, they can will themselves into having celiac disease. They can.
And also there's a level, right? So somebody who has minor gluten insensitivity might embellish that or make that seem much worse, you know, whereas she literally could be in physical danger by taking your average over-the-counter pills. Some people just, if they have a little bit too much bread, their stomach hurts, you know? So there's a range of it, and we have to distinguish between those. There's a new idea out that just came out based on this paper that celiacs could actually be the response to a reovirus.
Hold on, wait. Zika's doing this?
No, not Zika.
The reovirus.
Not from the river. No. REO virus. This is a series of viruses that essentially cause no physical effects in us. It's not like you get it and you have cold-like symptoms. You don't sneeze. You don't cough. You don't actually even know you have this virus. But the virus gets in your system. Your immune system learns to fight it. And the binders on the virus that the immune system goes after looks like the binders on gluten. So then after your immune system trains itself to go after this virus and kill it, gluten comes into your body. It sees that and it starts attacking gluten. They think, at least this is their hypothesis, that this might be what's causing certain forms of celiac disease.
How is that virus transmitted and where does it occur?
So it occurs naturally in human beings. It's transmitted from person to person through some kind of intimate contact. We don't know how long it survives because they're different series of these viruses and they're not well studied because they don't cause symptoms. But what they have found is a few things. One is they found at least one reovirus that causes extreme celiac-like gluten insensitivity in mice and in mouse models. And this is a particular reovirus we know is present in human beings. That in itself is interesting. But then they did follow-up research to see, because obviously they're not doing human trials already. They went back to people with celiac disease and started looking at them, and an abnormally high amount of them have the antibodies to this reovirus. That's really interesting, because what you're saying is more people than in the average normal population have these particular antibodies, indicating they had this virus at one time, and they're celiac patients. That's correlational, not causational, but it is interesting, and it does seem to provide a link.
The reovirus is actually the only virus that has carnival once a year. It's actually what causes the immune system to kind of go haywire.
I mean, that virus doesn't have a lot of like great scientists or inventors, but what an ass.
They're kid shows.
Very, very interesting, because one of the things they're thinking is it's a mixture of both your immune system and your genetic predisposition to kind of have an immune system that goes after a virus in this particular fashion. Obviously, not everybody who gets it will have this result. But one of the things they're thinking is maybe we can come up with vaccines for these otherwise inert viruses and give them to people with the genetic predisposition so that we can stop celiacs before it starts. That would be very, very interesting. You'd have to give it to young children, babies, before they get exposed to gluten, because once your immune system is set to it, it pretty much is set like that for life.
I'm sure it won't be any problem introducing another vaccine.
Yeah, no, everybody will love that.
Yeah.
Not being able to eat bread is a small price to pay for not having autism.
One of the things I think is interesting is this leads back to a topic we covered that was also very well covered on a show called Radiolab. One of the most interesting science stories I think of 2015, which is the AlphaGal story. That is where you get bit by a tick, and that tick introduces a virus to you, a disease. Your immune system fights off this disease in that same manner, and the binding sites on this particular disease look like the same stuff we find in mammalian flesh, everywhere except the human stomach. What that means is, after you get bit by this tick, your immune system fights off this disease, you then become allergic to mammalian flesh and cannot eat red meat, essentially indefinitely, meaning you can't have pork, you can't have beef, and it is sweeping through the South, which is specifically funny because they tend to like their red meat.
Well, you're more prone to get it if you're out in the woods hunting. So if you're out the type of guy who's out hunting meat, this is nature's curse. This is...
And that's really interesting. That's only come about in the last few years. We literally have only recognized it, like, in the last 2 or 3 years, we've recognized this AlphaGal allergy. And that could mean those people never get to eat red meat for the rest of their lives.
I still don't understand the name AlphaGal. Is that because all the females are vegetarians?
It's actually the protein that it is affecting.
A dominant lesbian discovered this.
One of the things I thought about this when I saw this, one is super interesting. It would be great if we could cure celiacs with this vaccine administered to babies at a certain time. Also, eventually you could have a similar type vaccine for people with that AlphaGal problem. But also I was wondering is, what if we can use this technique to engineer something we actually need? Like, what if, for instance, you can use this to create a virus that your body fights off and the binding parts look like opium or look like cocaine? We then give people this virus who have addiction problems, and from then on, they're allergic to cocaine. They're allergic to heroin. They can't have it anymore.
So you want to basically put an end to Burning Man?
No, that's mostly Molly.
Sounds like you want to kill rock music. That's what I hear.
Listen, if you can have cocaine or heroin and have fun with it and do your thing, I don't know how many people do that with heroin, but if you can, fine. But if you're an addict and you're seeking treatment, or if you've been convicted of a crime based on your addiction, we give you the shot, and then all of a sudden, you can't have that anymore. And your immune system will essentially indefinitely for the rest of your life keep you from taking those drugs. I mean, I always think whenever I see these things, I think, one, how interesting is it that we've discovered this? How interesting is it that celiacs might be caused by this? But two, what can we use this for? How can we mobilize this? How do we get CRISPR out of this little bit of bacteria DNA editing we have found?
What if instead of inserting genes that make it so we can't experience the sweet kiss of opium?
Right.
Maybe we made it so we changed our genes so we could metabolize it much faster, so I could kiss the dragon and go to work in the morning.
Okay, so what you're saying is you want a more responsible heroin high. By the way, I think they would also hate that too, because it would just cause them to have to steal more car stereos. Anyway, super, super interesting. Let's move right on to corrections.
And now it's time for corrections.
Guys, I love this. This is something that I love when it happens. I made a statement last week that, as of last week, science seemed to agree with. But as of an article published this week, science might disagree with. Very, very interesting. If you remember last week, we were talking about specific tests that can happen between a 3-year-old and a 4-year-old that will differentiate when they can see the world from another person's perspective. It was the mom putting the toy in the box on the table, the kid going outside, the mom moving the toy to inside of a cupboard, and when the kid comes back, does he look in the cupboard or the box? And anybody who is past the age of 4 or so who has made this mental connection would say they look in the box because they weren't there when the mom moved it. Before that age, that kid cannot relate to a person, can't think of the way they are thinking, doesn't have the same theory of mind, and therefore says they're looking in the cupboard.
Just to clarify, when you say the mom and the kid, then that's a scene that a kid that is being tested is observing.
Right. Right?
It's not the same kid that
exactly.
You test,
good
right?
point.
Like you watch a scene and then you judge whether somebody who wasn't present when something changed would notice the change. It's called theory of mind.
And if you want to get a more detailed explanation of all that stuff, go ahead and listen back to our last episode. We get into it. It's very, very interesting. We talk about why that is and the discovery that links that. One of the things I said during that topic was dogs, for instance, know when their owner is mad, just like 3-year-olds do, but dogs won't ever pass that test. Dogs would not have that type of theory of mind to be able to understand what that person's perspective would be and decide that they would look in the box, not the cupboard. However, just this week, something was published that might contradict that. It's actually a really interesting study that shows that maybe your dog could pass that test. Now, your dog wouldn't be able to answer your questions in terms of, do you think the kid's going to look in the box or the cupboard? He's not going to be able to answer that question. But he might actually have the mental ability.
Or she.
There ain't no rules saying a dog can't compete in a licensed science experiment.
That's true. Air beaker? Is that?
That's much better than I had.
All right. So this new test looked at a dog's ability to gauge the knowledge of human test participants to figure out where a specific piece of food is. So I won't get too far into the test, but it's basically the idea that the dog is unaware of where a particular piece of food is within three containers that are set in front of him. He has three observers, one in front of each of those containers. Food gets put into one, and those of you who are thinking might be like, wait a second, that dog's too smart. He can smell where the food is right away. They actually make all the containers smell like food to confuse the dog.
They actually pepper spray each of the dogs before the experiment.
And then the
So there's food in one of the containers that gets put in.
Without the dog seeing.
The dog doesn't see it, but the observers see it.
Yes.
And then the dog
has to try and figure out which one of those three containers has the food in it.
Uh-huh.
He does so by gauging the participant's actions towards the food container. So one of those containers has food in it. One of the participants knows about where that food is. He has knowledge that one of them knows, but not all of them. And he's going to gauge where that food is based on that. He does it based on their subtle cues, their eyesight, anything else. Now, this is a simpler test. This isn't the same test because he's not doing the same theory of mind of expanding out. But what he is doing is looking at the knowledge that one of those participants has as to where the food is.
So that's basically like Clever Hans 100 years ago.
Sort of and sort of not. So Clever Hans is a very interesting story in psychology where they thought a horse could do math for a while. What it actually was a person was subtly giving clues to that person.
Uh-huh. So we know that dogs and horses and...
Right.
I thought we were going to hear a German fairy tale for a second.
Right.
No, I can tell you one afterwards.
What is more interesting is get a little deeper into this and think of this implication. They're actually deciding which one of these people knows where the food is, as opposed to the one that doesn't.
So dogs would be great at poker. They're great at reading people. So
that's where the painting came from. That's actually a scientific painting.
The Air Bud of poker would be the best poker player.
I believe we decided it was called Air Beaker. So when the dog walks into that room, it mm-hmm. sees three people in front of three containers.
Mm-hmm.
One of them knows where, or at least is the knower. One of them knows where that particular thing is and is giving subtle clues. But the other...
Such like being all excited and flailing their arms.
Right. Now, looking sideways at the thing.
Uh-huh.
But the other ones might be giving other clues to the dog. The dog has to determine which one of these people actually knows where the food is and mm-hmm. which one doesn't. In a way... Kind of like Clever Hans, it's knowing the participants within it. But mm-hmm. it's also gauging the responses that people have when they actually know, don't actually know, or are trying to confuse the dog. So one of the reasons that this is important, one of the reasons this leads into that theory of mind idea, is the dog has to interpret not only what a person is doing, but the intention behind what that person is doing. Do they have no knowledge whatsoever of where that thing is? Or are they the knower?
Okay, so it is different in the sense that... So it is very sophisticated.
It
right?
is.
Like, it's very sophisticated, but it's not theory of mind.
No, not 100%, but they
no, do... No, it's actually like really one solid step removed because...
Sure.
Theory. The definition of theory of mind is that you are able to understand another person's perspective.
Right.
Not intention, perspective, knowledge state.
Right. So they have to know which one of these is the knower and which one is...
The shower.
Right. Actually, kind of right, because somebody is pointing at the wrong one, you know?
Oh, well, damn it.
And so in some sense, there is. You are right. This is certainly not the same type of theory of mind test. But this is a hint that certain dogs, and I should put in, by the way, that this isn't 100% test. We found about 70% of the dogs can figure this out, figure out who
Only
the knower is.
Only the German shepherds.
Yeah, or the border collies, like the smart ones, the poodles.
Do they control for like the probability? For example, I've never done the I fake throw a tennis ball.
Right.
The dog, like I didn't teach my dog not to not trust me. You know, like.
Like yes, they did control for assholes. Yeah. That's what you're asking.
If you throw the ball at the dog each time.
That would be more your style.
It's abuse. That's just abuse.
Anyway, while not necessarily a direct contradiction to what I said, it is an interesting titillating idea that maybe that actually would be a concept, a theory of mind that a dog could get to or have. And it's at least seeing things from a perspective that we did not think dogs were capable of.
I think great apes are capable of theory of mind.
They are.
Like the actual thing.
They do this test with bananas in food.
Of course, that's so racist.
And
to do
donkeys
with bananas.
Too.
Donkeys?
I think donkeys too. And I don't know.
I would be pretty surprised with donkeys.
Donkeys are pretty smart. Smarter than Damien, at least.
Like a smart ass is a
Yeah, there you go.
smarter than Damien. Like, am I going to lose to a stomping, clever? Like, he's not a Hans.
Yeah.
What's a low class German name?
Kevin.
Clever Kevin.
That donkey thinks he's so freaking smart.
Speaking of donkeys who think they're smart, let's head on to everybody's favorite game. I call BS.
I call.
Ring, ring.
I call BS.
All right, this is I Call BS, where I read four science news articles, and my panelists compete to see which ones are real and which ones are bad science. Are you guys ready to play?
Yes, I'm going to make Dr. Ava look like a very smart donkey.
You can call her Kevin. All right.
You totally slammed me last time. So I'm not going to lie. I'm scared.
All right. Article number one. A new graphene filter can be used as a simple sieve to pull the salt out of salt water and make seawater drinkable. Damien, is this science or bad science?
This is science. And I can't wait till this technology gets to straws. That way, people stranded at sea wouldn't die of dehydration.
Well, that's just an honest answer.
Yeah, I'm not even joking. I'm trying to save lives.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. And Dr. Ava.
I think it's science because that's something that has been in the works for a long time. It's about time that they figure it out.
It is about time. God. And you know what? Cure cancer, too. Yeah, stop fucking slacking off.
Well, cancer is a little more complicated.
I don't know. Saltwater's hard to do.
I hear if you run really cheap vodka through it, you get really good at vodka.
You can put it in a Grey Goose bottle and the girls will never know.
Maybe they just add sugar so that you don't taste it as much anymore.
Article number two. New research suggests having pets around pregnant women and young children may impair a child's immune system. Damien, is this science or bad science?
Jen Goodall here, and I'd like to say that I completely disagree with this. Being raised around a variety of animals has made my Sasquatch hybrid child never been sick. I've never had to take him to be vaccinated once.
There's a lot of Jane Goodall Sasquatch hybrid references. I think you're going to get sued at some point.
I should probably...
Rightly so.
That would be the best publicity this podcast has had.
You should stick to the dead scientists.
She is a scientist who believes that Bigfoot fucking exists, and I'm the bad guy.
Fair enough. All right, and Dr. Ava.
So I know that if you have cats, around pregnant women and little babies, then the cats sometimes have viruses that can be very, very harmful. On the other
and
hand...
And parasites, like toxoplasmosis.
And parasites, exactly. So, on the one hand, I want to say it's science because they impair a child's immune system. However, if the child lives to tell the story, then it might actually strengthen this immune system. So I'm kind of torn.
Everything's fun till your kid gets parvo.
I want to say it's science.
All right, on to article number three. A new study reveals the ability of humans to see polarized light with their eyes alone. Damien, is this science or bad science?
Is polarized light different from polarizing light, which is the light that comes from a TV with Fox News on it?
It is different, indeed. If you guys ever put on those glasses, you can see polarized light. Everything kind of shines in a different way. It's actually really hard to see LCD screens and power lines, so pilots not allowed to use them. But if you are just walking around, it actually makes the world look much cooler.
I'm going to say science, and I already gave you my joke. You don't get two.
All right. And in the first one, we didn't even get one. So, all right. And Dr. Ava.
I had LASIK, man. I can see polarized light. I can see x-rays. I can see everything.
Humble brag.
That's an interesting... You should talk to your doctor.
I'm a cyborg.
Yeah. And lastly, article number four, new research suggests that giant viruses may be the fourth branch of life. Damien, is this science or bad science?
What are the first three?
Good question, actually. First three would be eukaryotes, which is like us, plants, fungi, all that kind of stuff. Basically any multicellular stuff, bacteria, and archaea.
What are archaea?
Archaea weren't actually discovered until like the 70s. It's...
Oh, that makes me feel better.
Yeah.
I haven't discovered them yet.
It is,
look at the early stuff. Don't look at the archaea's later
stuff.
We
used to think they were bacteria. They're actually a whole different branch of life that is, I think, actually more closely related to eukaryotes than they are to bacteria. But this particular branch of life has things like methanogens, which we think actually caused the Permian extinction, the greatest extinction in Earth's history, because they created a bunch of methane. They're basically small, usually extremophiles. They live a lot by hydrothermic vents. They live in acidic-type water and stuff. They're very interesting little guys that can do very interesting stuff. But, despite what we thought, not bacteria.
How big are the giant viruses that you're talking about?
Big as shit. I don't...
This is... science. I know it's going to be a lot harder for regular-sized viruses to get into the virus NBA. That's for damn sure.
To answer your question, Ava, they're actually big enough that you can see them with a regular microscope.
Well, I think it's science because nobody makes this shit up.
All right, let's go back and see how you guys did. Follow along at home and see how you did. Article number one. A new graphene filter can be used as a simple sieve to pull the salt out of salt water and make seawater drinkable. Both of you guys thought this one was science, and this one is science.
Yes! It is, for so many reasons.
It is very cool because we might be able to make, like you said, literal straws that you can stick in the ocean and suck salt water through, making fresh water by the time it hits your lips.
Quit stealing my ideas, Bobby.
I actually have one of these straws called a life straw.
I do too.
It's for fresh water that has contaminants in it, and you can use it to get to kind of cleanse that water as you suck it out.
It's great for hiking.
Yeah.
If I were just to, like, drink pee out of that with that straw you've talked about.
Right.
How much pee is getting filtered out?
Let me ask you this. Why would you need the straw? Based on your current sexual habits, that seems like something.
They have Diet Coke for a reason. Right. You don't always want Coke. Sometimes you want Diet Pee.
I think you actually could probably do that, especially because urine is sterile. You'd probably get most of the urea out of there. But, this particular thing is a little different. It's been very hard to do this, and you can't underestimate how difficult this process is. Because of the way salt, the typical salt, binds in salt water, we have had filters before that were able to take out almost all the contaminants, even really large salts. The type of common salts that are in salt water are incredibly hard to get out, and previous use of graphene-type filters to try and do this wouldn't work because once it got into the water, the holes in the sieve would actually expand enough that the salt could still get through.
My dad always said that if there's too much salt, put potato in.
Do you think it's just a potato in a straw?
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling that old-timey German wisdom might be what we need right now. Forget these graphene filters.
He wasn't a cook or anything. He just was insane.
Yeah. But like I said, until now, they couldn't be used for sieving out common salts. Salts used in desalinization technologies. These ones can. The people at the University of Manchester found that if immersed in water, the membranes that usually swell up and allow smaller salts to flow through, the kind that are in salt water so that it doesn't act as a sieve, they found a way to keep the graphene membranes the same size and keep them from swelling up and allowing these salts through. In that case, you just put pressure on one side, push the water through, the salt gets stuck in the sieve, and everything else comes out the other side. We don't know the pressure variable, so it might not be able to be used in something like a straw. You might need more massive pressure. We're not sure yet. This is still in infant research stages, but it is very cool that they found this. This will make a difference in things, like you said, lifeboat technology. You have one of these things in a lifeboat, people could theoretically stay alive for a very long time.
I'd like one of these as well because I'm tired of when I order a margarita and I say no fucking salt, and there's salt. I look like an asshole when I send it back with this.
Yeah, this is what you'll use it for.
What would you use it for?
Well, saving lives.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about my PSA answer.
All right. On to article number two. New research suggests having pets around pregnant women and young children may impair a child's immune system. Damien says false. Ava says true. And this one is bad science. Sorry, Dr. Ava. While you are right about toxoplasmosis, that can impair a fetus, it doesn't actually impair their immune system. It kills the fetus.
So Dr. Ava was wrong, but Dr. Jane Goodall was right.
It is the opposite. In fact, this builds on research we've already had that says that having pets in the house can help childhood immunity, help stave off asthma. This has found an even stronger correlation to staving off asthma, even if you don't have it while the kid is born. If you just have it while the mom is pregnant with the kid, specifically dogs, and specifically ones that are allowed to go outside and inside. We think it has to do with exposure to dirt, to hair, to all these things that a child's immune system gets used to fighting off. It helps stave off things like asthma in later years. Not only does it help, they actually did some controlled studies and found in cases that we already know to decrease childhood immunity, such as C-section birth, administering antibiotics during birth, and lack of breastfeeding, which we all know decrease a child's immune system. Even in those cases, having a dog in the house increases the child's immune system. So this might be something that you want to do if you are having kids around, that you don't want to have asthma, that you don't want to have certain problems, especially if you are going to have a C-section birth.
So wait, you're telling me that in addition to have a tiny little human who needs you all the time, you also get a dog who needs you all the time?
Yeah, I mean, you get that shitty person, but then you have a dog, so it's awesome!
At least a kid learns to go to the bathroom by himself.
Hey, you know what a dog would do? A dog keeps out intruders. A dog protects your property, keeps out intruders. Yeah, occasionally bites your kid.
It loves you way more than a kid does.
Yeah.
The study suggests that the presence of pets in the house also reduced the likelihood of transmission of vaginal GBS, which is group B strep, during birth, which does happen sometimes. And the dog apparently increases the child's immune system even in utero to the point where it decreases the transmission of vaginal GBS.
So if I'm it's not vagina. Breast milk.
Okay.
All right. Okay, so I'm a mom. I'm not breastfeeding. Okay. Right. Could I take that nipple from the bottle? Just have the dog suck on the nipple for a bit.
Uh huh.
And then, like, can I use the dog to supplement where his immune system would be weak because I didn't do a vaginal swab on him?
I'm surprised it's not Dr. Damien, actually, because this seems like a great idea. Very, very interesting. Go get yourself a dog. Go to the pound, find yourself a dog, throw it in with the kids, and it'll make them all a little bit healthier.
Thank you for encouraging people to get a rescue.
And article number 3. A new study reveals the ability of humans to see polarized light with their eyes alone. Both of you guys thought this one was science, and this one is science, and it has a very cool story behind it. Those of you who have tried polarized glasses might be thinking, well, then why the fuck don't I see this regularly? Very, very interesting. You only see little clips of polarized light, and only in certain circumstances, but your brain actually filters it out. In the same way we all have a blind spot that you don't know about, it's where basically the optical nerve comes into the back of your eye. In that spot, there's a blind spot in your field of vision that you cannot see, but you are not aware of it. When you're looking around right now, you don't see a weird black spot. It's because your brain filters that out. It does the same thing.
It fills it in.
I sell mine for ad space.
In this case, your brain filters out this polarized light that you're seeing, but you still get glimpses of it, and you probably have seen this before and not even thought about it. You perceive polarized light using something called Haidinger's brushes, which is a subtle visual effect which appears like a yellow bow tie at right angles to the polarized angle. You might also see a bluish bow tie at right angles to the yellow one. The effect originates within the eye itself and is not the image of a real external object, so these brushes usually fade in a couple of seconds as your brain processes them. So, if you want to try this at home, you can. If you look at a blank white portion of the LCD screen on your computer or tablet or phone and tilt your head from side to side, a faint yellow and blue bow ties will appear slightly larger than your thumb around the corners of that image. And you can kind of see these sometimes. Sometimes you see certain elements of both polarized light and light effects, like the halo around a street lamp that you'll see sometimes, mm-hmm. or around the moon. Your brain normally filters these out, but if you pay attention and try it, which I did after reading this article, you can see it. It's actually very, very neat. So go home, use your phone, use your TV, use your computer, and try this out, and then recognize that we all have this kind of superhuman ability we never realized that we had.
We're all the shittiest X-Men ever. Gotcha.
It's actually something that they tell you when you do get LASIK that you see those halos more.
Oh, really?
And they don't... Maybe they should talk to you because they don't sell it as a superhuman ability. They sell it as you might have trouble with night vision.
One of 1,000 people sees dead people.
It's called the Haley Joel Osment effect. All right, and lastly, new research suggests that giant viruses may be the fourth branch of life. Both of you guys thought this one was science, and this one is... bad science. Congratulations, Damien, on your first win in ever. Recent memory. I think it's the first time this has happened.
I haven't been here for a while.
Bobby sustains a lot of concussions in between taping.
That's right.
He has a very short memory.
Decades, maybe, that you haven't won? I don't know.
Decades,
yeah.
Didn't I beat Dr. Ava the last time she was on? Weeks ago?
Cubs first win the World Series. When was that?
The first win?
Yeah, like early 1900s. Around then is when you had your last... I call BS win, but congratulations nonetheless. Way to go. You got a good job.
I'll come back next week.
Yeah, you did get a lot wrong for this win. It was really just a race to the bottom. But regardless, good job. Indeed, they did not find that the giant viruses might be a fourth branch of life. They found the opposite. So giant viruses
They're the second branch of life.
Right. Giant viruses are super interesting. They weren't even discovered till the 2000s. For the longest time, we thought these were just bacteria because they were so big, there's no way they could be viruses. You need usually an electron microscope, something like that, to see a virus. We could see these with regular optical microscopes, and researchers would just look at them and go, oh, look at that bundle. That's a bacteria. Well, there's no need to look at that. We'll keep going. It wasn't until the 2000s, specifically 2003, that somebody looked at this and was like, wait a second, this isn't a bacteria at all, and started looking and found out it was actually a huge motherfucking virus.
Is it just attached to huge cells? And
yes and no. It's weird that you say that, actually, because, by the way, these don't affect humans. These are usually looking after bacteria and going after bacteria and other things. But it's interesting here when you say, Bobby, when you listed the branches of life, you didn't say viruses. Well, viruses aren't alive. Viruses are self-replicating RNA. They don't have their own metabolism. They don't have their own cellular structure. They can't reproduce without another bacterial or human or animal cell.
I don't know very much about biology, but I did know that.
Right. And so because of that, viruses have always been considered this non-life entity, non-living entity. When researchers started looking at these large viruses, however, they realize that they could do things normal viruses can't do. They have pathways that involve metabolism. They have pathways that involve reproduction in a more cellular sense. They have these things, and we were looking and going, holy shit, is this a living thing? We're getting pretty close. What this new paper suggests by looking at in a very interesting manner, without going too in-depth, what they're doing is they're comparing different sections of genes that do these things in large viruses and saying, wow, they can do these things that normal viruses can't. And they compared different versions of, especially the Mimi virus, which was the first one discovered, the largest family of them. And they were looking at them and going, yeah, they have these abilities, they have these different gene codes, but they're all from different areas. What they realized is, what these viruses are doing is, they haven't come across a different viral line that maybe came down from archaea or something else. They're normal viruses that over time started stealing segments of DNA or RNA from their hosts and integrating it into their own code.
Thieves.
They are thieves. And that's why they're getting so big. They're stealing little bits of basically genetic material from the host that they're infecting, and they're putting it and they're making it part of themselves. And they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Now, they're still not able to completely pull off these functions on their own, but these segments of genetic material help them hide from their hosts so that their hosts' immune systems and ability to stop them goes away. Because if the bacteria's little cell structures that are trying to stop this virus from going in looks at this and recognizes, let's say, the cellular replication model of that particular bacteria, it's going to leave it alone. So it's using it as a cloak and dagger technique to get into the cell to try and infect it. It's not actually doing these things themselves. But while it's not the fourth branch of life, and while this paper seems to prove that it is not indeed a living thing and does not have a different lineage from other viruses, what is really interesting, and what is a question we should be considering right now, is if they take enough of that genetic material to be able to have their own metabolism, to be able to do self-replication without an outside host, would we be witnessing life from non-life? Because eventually, if it breaches a certain set of barriers, it becomes a living thing. We would be seeing non-living organic material become living organic material. That's really interesting.
Call me when it gets to sexual reproduction and film it for me. And
talk to me. Bacteria don't sexually reproduce.
That's why I don't masturbate to them.
That is not true.
I masturbate to the effects of them. MRSA, love MRSA. Yeah, that's my thing.
I have read that about you. Anyway, very, very interesting, because we might in our lifetime see a natural occurrence of non-living things become living things. That's going to piss creationists off, I guess, but it will be very, very interesting.
Or maybe Jesus has just come again.
As a giant virus.
Exactly.
I believe that was in the book of Revelations. All right, guys. We're going to come back next week. We are going to have Damian Channels, a dead scientist, next week. We are just going over time because we had so many interesting articles. But we will have that back next week.
Well, real quick, before we close out, we're not doing my bit here. But I know that this happened organically. But, Bobby, you're pretty good at traps and fooling people.
Right.
I think you did this on purpose. I mean, like, the science podcast cut the bit with the least amount of science in it in favor of more science education. That doesn't sound like the comedian made this decision.
That's true. I do have some ulterior motives, like educating humans.
So wait, next week we're going to start with a new theme.
We are going to start with a new theme. Thank you for reminding me. Make sure you get your tweets in, because it is this week or nothing, guys. You can't complain with whatever we come up with by the time next week starts.
What if we use a carrot and the stick situation with the audience?
Okay.
Carrot, A, congressman who denies science.
Right.
Stick, euphemisms for dong.
Literally a stick. Stick would be a euphemism for dong.
We're going to punish the audience with phalluses.
How about grammatical categories?
Nobody wants that. All right, so thank you, Dr. Ava, for coming back. It was fantastic to have you here. And while I don't remember exactly what happened in I Call BS, I'm pretty sure you beat Damien. And thank you.
Thank conceptually, you. I did.
Getting another concussion after this.
Thank you, audience, for coming out for 169, where you learned how we might have lost 80% of the universe, how a virus might be causing celiac disease, how we might have a new filter that will turn salt water into fresh water, how having dogs around pregnant women might help keep their kids' immune systems up, how humans can see polarized light without glasses, and why giant viruses aren't the fourth branch of life. Thank you so much for joining us. We can't wait to talk to you next week with our new intro bit. And come on back next week for Science Faction 170.
The new intro bit is going to be lit.
You've been listening to Science Faction. Wait, that's not right.
Damn, that's pussy.